Welcome to the Diplomats podcast on Asian geopolitics. I'm your host from New York City, Ankit Panda, and joining me on today's podcast is Jeff Smith. Thanks a lot for joining me, Jeff.
Good to be here.
Jeff is the author of Cold Peace, a fantastic book on India-China relations that particularly looks at perceptions between the two countries. And if you're interested in that book and the topic of India-China relations more generally, I'd recommend that you go check out an episode we did with Jeff last year on this podcast where we talked about that book in more detail. Jeff is the director of Asian Security Programs at the American Foreign Policy Council, and he's based in Washington, D.C. The reason I have Jeff on the show tonight is we're going to talk a lot about Indian foreign policy since Jeff studies that pretty closely. And actually, we're going to talk about India-Japan relations a bit, which is an interesting topic, certainly very close to my heart. I spent a few years studying this topic. And Jeff, actually, he's been looking at this recently. He was recently both in New Delhi and Tokyo. So I thought, Jeff, why don't we jump right into it? Why don't you tell us a bit about your trip to these two capitals, you know, what took you there, and really the big takeaways that you came back with? Because these two countries have been strategically converging over the past decade or so, and I think now more than ever things are very interesting between these to Asian democracies. So what were your travels like?
Sure. So I was in Delhi and Tokyo in late May, in part to conduct research for sort of a number of ongoing projects, a few book chapters I'm writing for different organizations, but mainly to take sort of temperature of Indian and Japanese views of the region. I mean, sometimes we get stuck in the minutia of watching this stuff day to day, but I really do think that the landscape has been changing rapidly over the past 6 months, and I think there's no secret that China is playing a big part in that. You know, since 2009, I think we've seen a more assertive posture from China broadly, and I think that's really begun to accelerate under President Xi Jinping. And just in the last 6 months, I mean, to add to the establishment of an air defense identification zone and the unveiling of this new Silk Road Initiative, the maritime territorial disputes. Now, in the last few months, you add on top of that these unprecedented land reclamation projects, the establishment of a new Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and what seems like a sort of ongoing standoff with the Obama administration over freedom of navigation patrols. And you have a very sort of fast-moving environment in Asia. And, you know, this is sort of centered in the Western Pacific, something maybe more directly relevant to Japan, but this is something that India is obviously watching very closely too. So the broad sense was to go over there and get, you know, gauge opinions, views, gauge the temperature. How are they seeing these recent developments in the region? What's the pace of India's engagement with Japan? How are India and Japan receiving this New Silk Road Initiative? How vigorously are they opposed to sort of these land reclamation projects? And are they concerned about these challenges to freedom of navigation? So those were some of the sort of big questions I tried to cover in interviews over there. I saw most of the regular suspects at various Indian and Japanese think tanks, got to talk to a few officials, and that came away with some sort of very substantive findings that put together in a trip report, but hopefully we can dig into some of that a little deeper now.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, let me start with Japan. What is the view of New Delhi from Tokyo? Are they pleased with the pace at which New Delhi and Tokyo have been cooperating on a variety of issues, particularly security? Let's talk about that. How do the Japanese view New Delhi?
Well, that's a great question. So the answer is mixed, but almost for polite sake. That is, I do genuinely think that the Japanese are pleased that this strategic partnership is advancing at a more rapid pace than it was before. But India does seem to be willing to play ball on strategic cooperation in ways it couldn't before. But, I mean, it was unmistakable, sort of broader sense of disappointment at the pace of that collaboration. And I mean, that was evident in a number of different ways. I mean, first, I was rather surprised to hear that Mr. Modi's visit to Japan, which was, I think, scored pretty well on the optics. I think they were slightly disappointed with the actual substance of the summit. I mean, one scholar put it to me that they had three real big takeaways that they wanted from the Modi visit, which was some kind of progress on a nuclear deal, some kind of progress on this long-pending sale of Chinmaywa aircraft to India. This was supposed to be Japan's first big export of defense equipment. It was signed back in 2012, and it's really sort of languished since on an Indian demand to build a majority of the planes in India. And the third one kind of surprised me, which is that the Japanese were more interested in starting a 2+2 dialogue with India, and that there was reservations from Delhi about that. I think the MEA might be getting cold feet about sort of adding a military component to it for fear out of offending China. Mm-hmm. But as we saw yesterday, they were fine with upgrading trilateral dialogue with the United States to the foreign minister's level. So I think the broad sense is that the Japanese want to be pushing this faster and harder than it's currently moving. But I think they are somewhat understanding that with India, there's a great deal of patience required and that things are moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. If I recall correctly, I think they've been holding 2+2 dialogues for a while now, but I think they've slowed the pace down now. And they obviously have their annual head of states summits. India and Japan, I think they're exclusive for each other in terms of Japan sends its prime minister to India and India sends its prime minister to Japan every alternating year. I believe they're the only two countries the only country with which they have that sort of relationship. What you said is fascinating because, I was in Tokyo and New Delhi, 3-4 years ago. And honestly, what you mentioned, the US-2 sale and the civil nuclear cooperation issue, those were the two things that people mentioned to me in Tokyo as well. So it's interesting to see how little things have changed in the 3 years.
I think he may have been referring to either an upgrading of the frequency of the 2+2 dialogue or roping that in with the trilateral dialogue with the U.S., upgrading that to a 2+2 level.
Gotcha. Yeah, that'd be a big deal if they ever did that. A trilateral 2+2 would be pretty impressive. Can I just ask you a bit about the nuclear issue? So, I've always kind of looked at this nuclear dispute between Japan and India as a major point of dissent between the two countries. I mean, I think it's difficult for me to imagine two countries that could be more different on the nuclear front. I mean, Japan is famous at international fora for, opposing nuclear weapons, even though it enjoys the U.S. nuclear umbrella. It obviously suffered at the hands of nuclear weapons at Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. India, meanwhile, is a nuclear weapon state that isn't even part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And that's kind of, been a bit of a stumbling block when it comes to their civil cooperation deal. I mean, India obviously made a huge breakthrough in the mid-2000s with the U.S.-India a civil nuclear cooperation deal, which changed essentially how India is viewed on the world stage as a nuclear power. But there's still this huge problem with Japan. So, when you were in Tokyo, what were the Japanese telling you? What's keeping this deal up from being concluded?
I have to say they didn't frankly get into specifics. I can say they didn't seem all that surprised that they said that was the one issue where they saw the least likely to be any movement during Modi's visit. But that it was something that they wanted to continue working on with India and that they kind of recognized this may take a long time. Another issue they did bring up, which I know is of interest to you, was the sort of Malabar exercises.
Right, absolutely.
Prime Minister Modi and President Obama had sort of at both summits vaguely agreed to upgrade the Malabar exercises, and it was widely believed that they would begin to more regularly include Japan. So these were, as you know, bilateral naval exercises between the U.S. and India that have been going on since the 90s. We began to include others in 2007, sort of famously promoting the Quad initiative, where we exercise with Japan, Australia, and Singapore.
Yeah, interesting to know that Abe was prime minister back then as well.
Yes, and he's been sort of the most vigorous proponent of this Quad initiative. So that raised enough hackles in Beijing that the Quad initiative sort of fell apart the next year when Australia elected a left-leaning government.
Mm-hmm.
We've sort of invited the Japanese to exercise with the U.S. and India again in 2009. And then in 2014 as well. But each one of those exercises was held in the Western Pacific. This year, the Malabar exercises in October are going to be held in the Indian Ocean. And I know it's sort of Tokyo's wish that they be included for the first time in a trilateral way in the Indian Ocean. And I understand they issued some kind of sort of diplomatic note when the first planning session for the Malabar exercises was held in April and Japan wasn't invited. Now, I understand it's going to be resolved in July and that the window is still open to include Japan, but they very much want to get more involved in the Malabar exercises, in strategic engagement and military engagement more broadly, and they're pushing the pace, frankly, I think as fast as the Indians will allow it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the regional situation, as you mentioned at the beginning of this all, is going to be very important here. I mean, privately, officials in New Delhi and Tokyo, again, a few years ago, you know, they told me that one of the major issues holding back sort of broader military cooperation between India and Japan was the optics facing China. I mean, India is obviously concerned because, you know, India has its own border dispute with China and the economics issues, as our listeners are well aware. And any time India and Japan come together, the message for Beijing is unmistakable. People in Beijing are aware that both these countries have their disputes with China, and they perceive China as this rising threat in Asia. And if they begin to cooperate on security issues, that's obviously going to raise some red flags. But, all those developments you mentioned recently, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, obviously the land reclamation activities in the South China Sea, the Maritime Silk Road, which is part of the One Belt, One Road Initiative, all of these things didn't exist when I was talking to officials in Tokyo and New Delhi. So what has been, if you saw any optics, maybe let's move over to the New Delhi side since you were there as well. So, what was the impression in New Delhi, at least, for how India can bring Japan into the fold as it thinks about reacting to these new developments in Asia?
Well, maybe we'd take a step back first and just sort of contextualize how India's been seeing China.
Yeah, sure, do that, absolutely.
So I think a big question mark for a lot of people when Narendra Modi was coming to office was how would he approach China? There'd been sort of mixed signals about certainly his desire for increased Chinese investments. He had visited China many times to great fanfare, but he was a nationalist leader, and I think it was no secret that many people around him that ended up making it into his cabinet were no great fans of China. And, in this first year in office now, I think you've continued to get some mixed signals from him. But I think as I was thinking about this and talking to people in Delhi, I think the best way to sort of characterize his approach to China is simply by saying more confidence. And that is more confidence to pursue engagement and economic investments, but also more confidence to sort of tell Beijing sort of uncomfortable truths or, speak more provocatively about freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, or sort of just push more vigorously for India's interests. So I thought it was interesting that the reaction to Mr. Modi's visit to China was that I think there was a sense that he may be different, that, using his sort of personal charm and his own leadership qualities, he would be able to go to China and sort of court them and charm them and negotiate with them in a way that his predecessors were unable to do. And I think although the optics of that visit were pretty good as well, I got a sense in Delhi that, they thought on the substance, they really came up short, that the Chinese really didn't put anything on the table, that despite sort of speaking highly about the prospects for India-China relations in the future, were unwilling to budge on even sort of low-hanging fruit. And I really got the sense that they viewed the potential for any breakthrough on the border or real movement on some of the more contentious issues as sort of fast receding. Mm-hmm. So I think the perception of China in Delhi right now is broadly negative, and some of the security experts were fairly explicit in saying things like China is driving us together with other middle powers in Asia, maybe not as a military alliance, but as an insurance policy against unpredictable Chinese behavior.
Yeah, just as a quick divergence, since we're talking about Modi's trip, can we talk a bit about, India's relations with Mongolia and Vietnam? I mean, obviously, people have been seeing these as sort of New Delhi trying to give Beijing a taste of its own medicine. Obviously, you talk to strategists in New Delhi, they'll tell you that they're concerned about China's relations with Sri Lanka, with Pakistan. They feel encircled by China's inroads in their own region. And as a flip side, New Delhi's been pursuing strategic relationships with Vietnam, Mongolia, these states that are in China's periphery. Can you speak a bit to that?
Sure. Actually, less so about Mongolia, but I did, as I usually do, hear chatter about Vietnam. I mean, the way they spoke about ASEAN and the Southeast Asian countries was still with a bit of sort of reservation. I mean, I remember one conversation you know, the question was, you know, they want us to support them in their territorial disputes. How many times have ASEAN countries come out in favor of our position on the China border when there are incursions by Chinese forces? But the sort of one exception has always been Vietnam, which I think they speak much more highly of and see, continue to see a lot more of a window of opportunity for strategic collaboration. In fact, they said, I think Delhi hosted the prime minister or president of Vietnam last fall, and they said that the visit, although sort of in public, it was played down a bit because fairly senior ranking Chinese official was in Vietnam at the time, that in private the substance was actually very strong. And I think they said Mr. Modi made some very strong and committed remarks about where he intended to take that relationship. So I would say the opinion in Delhi is rather bullish on the India-Vietnam engagement. You still don't really get a sense of if and when there's ever going to be movement on a BrahMos deal. That's been sort of in limbo for some time now. India's been considering selling relatively right. advanced cruise missile to Vietnam for some time, which I think some see as perhaps a signal, if that does happen, that India is ready to sort of take strategic engagement to the next level. I didn't see any prospect for quick movement on that while I was there.
Yeah, there's also the Russian angle on the BrahMos sale as well, since it's a jointly developed missile. Also, you know, I just note that the Vietnamese defense minister was in India just a couple weeks ago, I believe. And him and Parikar, the Indian defense minister, concluded a few maritime security agreements, which is actually funny. You know, I don't want to make this conversation too complex, but I saw some mirrors there with what Ash Carter just announced in Vietnam. So when you look at the United States and India, at least, regarding the relations with Vietnam, I think you're starting to see a bit of parallelism there, which yes. I think is very interesting. But anyways, I think we're at risk here of getting into this, getting fully into the geopolitical complexity of Asia, which is obviously fascinating, which is what we do day in, day out as Diplomat. But I just want to take a step back and bring this back to India-Japan, which is, you know, the topic of interest here. So, you know, we talked a bit about Japan and Japanese perceptions of the situation. We talked about India. I'll also add that I think late last year when Pranab Mukherjee, the Indian president, visited Vietnam, I believe that was the first time India included the South China Sea and calls for freedom of navigation and backing international law explicitly in a joint statement. And then we saw that during Modi's statement with Obama in September 2014 as well. And yes. Since then, India has been including that very regularly in its diplomatic language. So we are starting to see New Delhi take more of a position on the South China Sea issue. So how do you see, you know, India and Japan either, you know, coming together bilaterally, or at least, you know, working with third states like the United States, like with Australia, in sort of managing the China challenge, the China threat in Southeast Asia, you know, specifically with the South China Sea, and initiatives like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which I know has caused some concern. India is a member of that, I should note, for our listeners, but Japan is not a member, and there are concerns in both capitals about the intentions of this organization.
Well, I think unless you see a willingness from the Modi government to move away from the sort of skittishness when it comes to defense cooperation at a trilateral level, particularly, I think the pace of cooperation is going to continue to be rather modest. And I think the Japanese are going to, as I said before, continue pushing as hard as they can. But I think they see the concerns in the Western Pacific and the threat level as rising so fast and so quickly that I'm not sure they're sort of banking on direct Indian help anytime soon. So as I said before, I think they're going to continue to push sort of coalitions of the willing where they can. And if they see there's a lot more room for opportunity with the US and Japan, I think I saw that Japan was going to, just today, Japan announced that it was going to participate in drills on Australian territory with the U.S. later this year. That would be their first.
Yeah, Talisman Sabre. Yeah, they're participating along with New Zealand in that exercise for the first time.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, I find that significant. And even from the Indian side, I remember one conversation, they said sort of they see this coalition emerging to sort of balance and ensure against China. And in the immediate ring, they said they saw the U.S. and Japan. And then in sort of this middle outer ring, they saw countries like Vietnam and India and maybe Indonesia. But I think they don't see themselves as sort of direct directly threatened by the territorial disputes in the Western Pacific. And frankly, I think their assessment of their capacity to deploy military force in the Western Pacific, I think they see that as still being rather modest, and I'm not sure that they're incorrect. So I think that sort of skittishness about offending Beijing, which you've seen some indications from the Modi government that they're sort of shedding some of that, but it's obviously still there to some degree. And I think that's going to continue to hamper the pace. But you know, the Japanese, I believe, are willing to be patient on this, like the Americans are. I mean, we had to learn this lesson the hard way, that things with India never move as quickly as you want them to. Mm-hmm. But I sort of can't emphasize how much the Japanese really are concerned with the pace of change in the Western Pacific and questions over sort of America's commitment long term to the region. I mean, sort of doubts that you hear regularly expressed about whether there's actual substance to the pivot, or is the U.S. just talking the talk because we really don't see it walking the walk. And frankly, I don't think that's entirely founded. But that is, I think, a strong perception over there.
And definitely. Mm-hmm.
What they're saying is, look, we need to sort of diversify our security relationships, especially in the face of what they see as relative U.S. military decline in the region. So they're going to pursue these new relationships with Australia and Vietnam and potentially India as aggressively as they can. There was actually some movement on a long pending deal. Australia has been interested in buying Japanese submarines for some time. Mm-hmm. And I think the Japanese were for a while very hesitant about sharing sort of high-end technology on the sub, even to submit a proper bid to the Australian government. And just last week, I think the Japanese cabinet approved the sort of transfer of technology, at least of the information to provide a sufficient bid for the submarine. So there is movement on a lot of these different bilateral routes.
Yeah, I'd say, you know, just watching the foreign relations of these two countries and their security affairs, I would say that, you know, Japan has definitely transformed in a more dramatic way than India has. You know, for all that I credit Modi with, and, you know, he surprised me. He was a far more dynamic prime minister on foreign affairs than I expected and a lot of other commentators expected. Everybody expected him to kind of be the inward-looking, you know, the big he's going to fix India's economy. And he's obviously, you know, if you've been reading the commentary on Modi's first year anniversary, a lot of commentators have been disappointed with that to an extent. But yet, foreign affairs, he visited 18 countries in his first year in office. And, you know, he came back with deliverables. And but, you know, when you look at Indian foreign policy from, you know, a 30,000 feet strategic level, and you compare him to Manmohan Singh's predecessor, you know, the Manmohan doctrine, if it existed, and I think, you know, some commentators called it that, was primarily about India's economic growth. And for Modi, if you look at initiatives like Make in India, his bids for investment around the world, it's also been, you know, similar to that. And, you know, Modi has somewhat transformed India to a position of omni-alignment. But a result of that has been not really seriously thinking about, you know, partnerships that New Delhi would like to pursue with countries like Japan, with countries like Vietnam. And I think we'll see more of that. I think it will take time. You know, something that Indian commentators love to mention is the metaphor of, you know, an elephant never makes sharp turns, which I think is a little bit trite. But, you know, I think it kind of explains Indian foreign policy in a slightly poetic way. I don't know how you feel about that metaphor.
No, I think I'd agree with you completely.
Okay, great. Yeah. Like I said, I think it's a little bit tried. I actually want to ask you a bit about your impressions of U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter's recent trip to India. Obviously, it didn't really generate the kind of headlines that, you know, a high-level U.S.-India bilateral on security issues normally does. I mean, I think they came away with like $1 million in deals. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking about defense partnerships or defense in general, you don't really hear numbers that small. Right. So I think that was a little bit jarring to some people. And obviously, the major outcome was the 10-year renewal of the U.S.-India defense cooperation framework, which really, you know, is less of a document showing concrete commitments. It's more a statement of intent. But, you know, what was your takeaway on this? Is this a good step in bringing the United States and India together?
I think it is. And I think that the substance and the tangible sort of reaction to that the very sort of monetarily modest deal signed there is more important than their value would suggest. I mean, I think the Indians have for a long time wanted co-development. I mean, that's the emphasis, is that working together, information sharing, making projects in India, building faith and trust on even small projects can go a long way. I think with their MOD, they emphasized that they really did hope and want to see movement on the four Pathfinder projects, that regardless of sort of the monetary value of them, that these were symbolically important step to greater defense cooperation. And I think the sort of general mood on U.S.-India relations was better than I had seen it a year or two ago. I think they're sort of optimistic about this collaboration on carrier tech. America's top technical expert on carrier technology, I understand, is due to visit India soon. He may even be there this week. Is that this week?
I think so, yeah. I think, I mean, just on that note, I think, Carter was very careful during every press conference in New Delhi to emphasize that, look, I know we're just signing $1 million in deals right now, and we have this 10-year document, but the big things are yet to come. And he specifically kept mentioning aircraft carrier tech, and I think that's going to be a big one for New Delhi, particularly if it manages to, you know, put together the INS Vishal. It's a 65,000-ton carrier with a nuclear tech and a U.S. electromagnetic launch systems. I mean, that would be a huge coup. It would be the only only France, the UK, and the United States operate carriers with that tech. And, India would have a huge leg over China. And I think that's a big part of what New Delhi wants. And obviously, I think the United States is positioned pretty well to supplant Russia's historic role with India as an important co-development partner in defense. I mean, you look at projects like the BrahMos and, the upcoming PAKFA, the fifth generation fighter aircraft project. I mean, those have been well, at least the latter has been derailed to an extent. I think this is a prime opportunity for the United States to sense strategic opportunity here to swoop in. I think the Pentagon's picking up on that.
I think you've seen in the last few years a tremendous amount of public dissatisfaction with defense cooperation with Russia, whether that's withholding spare parts, upping the cost of projects after they've been signed, with the quality control on Russian MiG fighters, to name just one example. I asked about this, and they said, actually, it's nothing different. We've always been extremely dissatisfied with Russia on these issues. It's just becoming public now. And, maybe the newfound cooperation between Russia and Pakistan is helping some of this bubble to the surface. But there's no question that India is looking to diversify its defense relationships. And I think it wants more with the U.S., but I think some of its requirements, its Make in India requirements and its offset requirements are, although there's actually been a little bit of movement on those recently, are still too onerous for U.S. defense companies to consider any of these projects profitable.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, then there is the issue of intellectual property transfer, which is big for New Delhi. I'd also add that, while New Delhi and the United States have really been converging, I mean, India's been retaining its independence. I mean, for example, you look at the Javelin versus Israel's Spike. That went in favor of Israel, and Modi is heading there in a few months. I think that'll be something else to watch. India's clearly looking to diversify its partnerships. And that's, been the historical frustration in Washington, is that New Delhi is happy to tango with anyone to an extent. And, I think the United States would like to pursue, meaningful strategic cooperation with a degree of exclusivity with India, and really leverage this commonality between these two countries as the world's oldest democracy and as the world's largest democracy, as people in both countries will have to tell you. So yes. I think it'll be an interesting partnership to watch.
Well, what one thing I thought that was poignant that somebody noted was they said, look, it wasn't even too long ago, maybe 10, 15, 20 years that we wanted all American forces out of the region. We wanted an Indian Ocean zone free of American forces. We even wanted you out of Diego Garcia. Now we're begging you to stay in Afghanistan. We want you to stay in the Middle East, and we're inviting your troops on our soil to do joint exercises. Let's not sort of lose track of how quickly this has come along in a relatively short period of time in historical terms. I thought that was made some sense. That's why I always try and caution lawmakers here in the U.S. sort of patience in dealing with India.
Definitely. You'll be rewarded if you're patient, hopefully at least. Anyways, Jeff, thanks a lot for joining me tonight. I'm afraid that's all the time we have, but obviously this discussion could have gone on a lot longer. For those of you listening, if you liked Jeff's remarks, I really recommend you go check out his book, Cold Peace. That focuses more on India-China relations, but it's a very thorough treatment of the topic, which is immeasurably complex. And it actually has very insightful chapters on how Indians perceive China and vice versa, which is a little bit of an understudied topic these days. Jeff, thanks a lot. And I'll look forward to your writings based on your travels to New Delhi and Tokyo.
Thanks, Ankit.